Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Wharton Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on ancient Israel's rise to greatness, the first British and American Empire about 1000 BC, when we come back. Now, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? Well, it's obvious that something is wrong with them because they have been banned from our public schools, our public institutions, and our national consciousness. Instead of these 10 simple, time-tested laws, we now see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place, and they teach the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, public institutions, and we've made them a part of our national psyche. Now, this is a radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years, don't you think? Are you aware that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but your daughter can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent? And that's why I contend that the solution to this kind of moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Well, let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. Our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's still one school left in America that still teaches this entire Mosaic Law and the Ten Commandments and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the 33 benefits that you receive for their observance. You know, every law has a penalty. And if you don't have to know what that law penalty is to suffer its effect. So whether you call that the Mosaic Law or the Law of God or common law or natural law or karma or something else, it's automatic. And it works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happens to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call right now and order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. 4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org, click on the email, and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we took a look at the identification of the modern day Israel nations of America and Great Britain. In ancient times, they were referred to as Ephraim and Manasseh. Many prophecies in the scripture deal with Ephraim, Manasseh, Israel, and Judah. Judah, remember, was the southern kingdom with their dynasty of kings, and Israel was the northern kingdom and had its dynasty of kings. And all of these Israelite countries have been fighting and warring with each other forever. Remember, right from the very beginning, it was the brothers, the physical, literal brothers of Joseph, that sold him into slavery. If you take a look at the spats that go on between the United States and France, or the United States and Germany, or if you take a look at the Danes, do you remember the Vikings used to come around down the coast of Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and Britain, and raid them? They were called the Vikings. You know, the wars between nations aren't limited just to outsiders. It's also friendly wars, like our American Civil War, one of the bloodiest, nastiest, most hate-filled wars that we've been involved in was, you know, among ourselves. And the same thing is true between the United States and Great Britain. We fought two major wars, you know, with the British. And still, they're our buddies, and today, we're over there in Iraq fighting side by side with those Tommies. And in World War I and World War II, you notice that when the Germans got after the British, well, guess who was right there to help them? It was those Yanks. So, last time, we went through and we looked at the historicity, and we looked at the prophecies, looked at Bible prophecy concerning the identification of the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Great Britain in the Bible. Now, let's go back and let's pull together here in the United States, in southern Canada, where these ancient peoples, the ancient forebears of our people today, came to the United States and they left graves, mounds, pyramids, monuments, artifacts, and writing all over New Hampshire, Arkansas, Ohio, West Virginia, Kansas, Colorado, New Mexico, Michigan, and many other states. I mean, it's right there today, boys and girls, and you can go right out there and look at it. And I've spent some time now that it's come to my attention that these monuments are out there, these graves and mounds and pyramids with all of this Celtic writing on it, and Hebrew and Phoenician writing. Now it's piqued my curiosity. I said, my God, it was right here in front of us all this time. That's why Gloria Farley wrote her book. It's called In Plain Sight. Well, another factor that powerfully supports a dating of this ancient Hebrew inscription to the time of Solomon are the economic and logistic realities in the ancient world. You see, transoceanic expeditions and colonization efforts in the ancient world required a very large commitment of monetary and human resources. Now, the source of such resources had to be the king of a wealthy nation, because the New Mexico inscription is in ancient Hebrew. The sponsor for that ancient expedition had to be a very wealthy king of the ancient Israelites. Solomon was the wealthiest ancient king of Israel, and he reigned at a time when the Israelites were keeping the Ten Commandments. Now, the high cost of financing transatlantic voyages is verified when you consider the European colonization efforts, which began when Columbus rediscovered America in 1492. European colonization at the beginning of the modern era required the backing and the approval of national monarchs in order to occur at all. Even companies with a large presence in the New World, such as the Hudson's Bay Company, conducted their efforts only with the support and favor of a reigning monarch. And those who would argue for a more recent date for the Las Lunas inscriptions are confronted with this major problem. What old world nation in the 4th century AD, or any other date more recent than Solomon's reign, would fund such an exploration and or colonization effort here in the New World, which would leave behind ancient Hebrew inscriptions? Since there were no powerful and rich Hebrew-speaking nations in the 4th century AD, any such proposed dating lacks the support of any logical historical context for such an occurrence. Now, because the Las Lunas inscription proclaims its makers were devoted to the God of the Ten Commandments, we are limited to those kings of Israel who could have funded international expeditions during Israel's brief period of loyalty to God. This requirement limits the prospective dating of the Las Lunas inscription to the reigns of Kings David and Solomon. You know, you couldn't even do that today. America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Britain, we're all sun-worshipping pagans today. We don't practice the Ten Commandments. Can you imagine the Ten Commandments being inscribed anywhere by NASA? NASA identifies all of their activities with the names of pagan gods like Jupiter and Apollo, not by the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, that Las Lunas stone down in New Mexico was a rare find. It's the only one I know of that represents a period of history, a period of archaeology, where we, the Israelite people, were obeying God. Now, it happened from time to time. And there have always been Israelites that would obey God and keep his commandments. You know, 7,000 in Israel during the time of Elijah. I wouldn't be a bit surprised, but what, there's 7,000 Israelites today in Australia that keep the Ten Commandments, obey God and keep his commandments. But let me tell you, boys and girls, they are rare, very rare. Now, the kings of Israel that followed David and Solomon were almost without exception apostates who served Baal and other idolatrous gods. Under later kings, any sailing fleets would have left inscriptions devoted to pagan gods, as in the inscriptions on the trilingual Davenport artifact. In fact, I'm going to interject this right here. I happened to go down to, I think it's Heavenly or Heavenly, Oklahoma, where the lady that wrote In Plain Sight is where she lives. And she invited me down there, and she said, why don't you go out here and look at this monument. Her name is Gloria Farley. And we went over and looked at it. And the inscriptions over there that are written on there are written to Baal, the sun god. In fact, everything in her book, In Plain Sight, shows that all of these monuments that they uncovered, that Dr. Fell uncovered and Gloria Farley and many of these others of the Epigraphic Society, they're pagan in nature, and they're devoted to sun worship and pagan idolatry. Everyone without exception. Only the Las Lunas stone, which has the Ten Commandments on it, is the only exception to that. Now, the kings of Judah, who survived until 587 B.C., had several righteous kings whose followers served God, but Judah was a small nation with very few resources to fund and mount such expeditions. Judah had interludes of resurgent national power, but there is no record that Judah was ever a naval power. 1 Kings 22, verses 48 and 49, and 2 Chronicles 20, verses 36 and 37, record that the righteous King Jehoshaphat tried to build a fleet for Judah, perhaps to compete with the fleets of Israel and Phoenicia, but God himself intervened to stop Judah from becoming a naval power. Therefore, the only logical historical context for the making of the Las Lunas inscriptions is still during the reigns of either King David or King Solomon. Now, since King David was a warrior and had very little interest in scientific endeavors, the reign of his son, King Solomon, is the most logical for any expeditions or colonization efforts which had Israelites carving inscriptions in ancient America proclaiming a loyalty to the God of the Bible. And also King Solomon's insatiable scientific curiosity about the world's flora and fauna, as we read in 1 Kings 4, verses 29 to 33, and 1 Kings 10, verse 22, made Solomon eager to fund international expeditions. Now, this author has personally visited and inspected the Las Lunas inscription, and the site is located adjacent to a large dry riverbed. This vanished river would formerly have been a major tributary of the Rio Grande. During a wetter climate, when the river flowed freely, as the dry riverbed attests, there was once enough water in the ancient Southwest to support thriving colonists. And it's likely Likely that the ancient Israelites established a colony at the Las Lunas site during the time of King Solomon, when the area could be reached by way of sailing routes from the Gulf of Mexico and the tributaries of the Rio Grande River. When the climate reverted to its dominant arid condition, the colony would have been abandoned. Now, in an attempt, or in an apparent attempt, to discredit the validity of the ancient Hebrew translation of the Las Lunas inscriptions, some artifacts were discovered in the region of the Las Lunas inscriptions, and certain individuals asserted that these new artifacts indicated that the Las Lunas inscriptions were Greek, not Hebrew, Greek writing from about 500 BC. And in a 1986 court trial, it was conclusively demonstrated by expert epigraphers, linguists, that while the Las Lunas inscription is a valid Hebrew rendition of the Ten Commandments, the other artifacts and the supposed Greek translation were hoaxes. Additional evidence of ancient worshippers of the Bible's God in ancient America has been noted on a Decalogue tablet. That's an artifact bearing an ancient Hebrew inscription of the Ten Commandments unearthed in Ohio in 1860. Now, besides having the Ten Commandments inscribed upon it, the tablet includes a depiction of an individual meant to represent Moses, which has been carved in considerable detail on the front of the tablet, and a handle at the bottom of the tablet, which may have been constructed to accommodate a strap. Now, the presence of a handle on this tablet indicates that it served as a portable object which could accompany worshippers of God as they were traveling in ancient America. Now, this Decalogue tablet was found with grave goods in an ancient American burial mound, and its presence suggests that the person interred in the mound may have been an ancient Levite present with Israelite explorers or colonists in ancient America. Now, see if that's better. Now, there are these graves and mounds all over the Midwest. In fact, down around Heavenly, Oklahoma, there's a group of mounds down there. Oftentimes, these mounds were broken into, especially during the Great Depression, to see what they could get out of them there because times were so tough. People resorted to grave robbing. Well, these mounds that we find here in the United States are now all covered, you know, with brush and trees, and oftentimes they're totally concealed. But when they go into them, they almost invariably find artifacts from ancient peoples. Those ancient peoples are invariably Hebrews. You don't find the Russians over here or Chinese or anybody else. What you find here in America in these ancient artifacts, like in New Hampshire, down Heavenly, or out in, near Denver, Colorado, they're always Hebrew ogham, or they're always Hebrew and Phoenician writing. There's been a number of Roman coins found here in the United States. That's another story from later, not as early, not as far back as 800, 1000 BC, but rather from around the time of Christ. Now, the Decalogue tablet was found with grave goods in an ancient American burial mound, and its presence suggests that the person that was interred there may have been an ancient Levite. This Decalogue tablet, in its original box, is shown here on the page, and it's a little portable Ten Commandments. Now, while this artifact unearthed from an Ohio burial mound cannot be specifically dated, the alphabet used on the stone indicates that it was made by ancient followers of God who spoke Hebrew. Now, while it would be tempting to date this artifact to the time of King Solomon, the fact that it was engraved with square Hebrew letters indicates a date several centuries more recent than the Las Lunas tablet, which exhibited the more ancient Paleo-Hebrew letters. Now, this raises the possibility that there were Israelite colonists in the New World who remained loyal to the laws of God long after the Old World Israelites abandoned them. Linguistic traits in the New World could also be retained for a greater length of time due to their remoteness from the Old World and its linguistic changes. And more evidence of a Hebrew presence in ancient New England in the area of the 20-acre temple site discussed earlier is seen in the presence of hundreds of Hebrew Semitic root words in the languages of the Eastern Algonquin Indians, as Dr. Barry Fell documented. He said, whatever the dating of the above artifacts, such discoveries provide firm archaeological support to the Bible's assertion that the ancient Israelites sponsored wide-ranging fleets and were one of the major nations of the ancient world. Now, since the Ten Commandments in ancient Hebrew have been found in both Ohio and New Mexico, it confirms that ancient Israelite explorations and or colonizations of the New World were certainly widespread. Now, these facts may be disconcerting to the establishment historians and archaeologists and other sources who cling to this flawed dogma that Columbus discovered America in 1492. No matter how voluminous the evidence that Israelites and other Old World civilizations sent explorers or colonists to the New World, this evidence will become ever more voluminous and convincing as this book series continues. Now, hundreds of inscribed Phoenician, Celtiberian and Basque stone grave markers dated to 800 to 600 BC have been found in the Susquehanna Valley of Pennsylvania. The inscriptions on these artifacts had been identified as Phoenician decades prior to Dr. Fell's research. But these facts were incompatible with the dogmas and assumptions of modern historians, so they have been totally ignored. But the graves are still there to this day, and they're not moving, they're not going anywhere, whether we believe them or not. The Egyptian presence in the New World has been found in the writing system of the Wabanki, Mi'kmaq Indians, and the Algonquin tribe of Maine, in an ancient tablet found on Long Island in New York, and on the Iowa Stele, mentioned earlier in this chapter. Also, it has been documented that the ancient Egyptians sailed the Pacific Ocean as far as Polynesia and Hawaii, as they roamed the Indian and Pacific Oceans for gold about 1000 B.C. So the date of 1000 B.C. parallels the golden age of Israel's empire days, or empire days, under Kings David and Solomon, when the Bible records that Egypt was allied to King Solomon's Israelites. Now I'm going to pause here for a moment and tell you a little personal experience I had. I was over in Hawaii some years back, and we went into this museum in Honolulu. And the fellow that we were with, a native Hawaiian, was explaining Hawaiian history, culture, and tradition. And while we were going through the museum, as it turns out, about 1893, the United States government overthrew the monarchy, or the queen of Hawaii, in 1893 during Grover Cleveland's term of office. And that's a real sore spot with the Hawaiians. Now, while we were in the museum, though, we came upon an exhibit of how the queen and her, I'd forgotten how it was her father before her, had practiced the Jubilee years. The years of release and jubilees were being practiced in Hawaii by the Hawaiians before the white man came. And I said, well, my God, the only people that ever practiced land Sabbaths and jubilees that are described by law in Leviticus chapter 25 are the Israelites. And until I read this book, the one here, The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel, it didn't dawn on me that the Israelites had gone as far afield as Hawaii. Now I know why. They learned in Hawaii 1000 B.C. about land Sabbaths and Jubilees, and until about the mid-1850s, they were still practicing that. The native Hawaiians practiced land Sabbaths and Jubilees, not Israelites. While that's our law, came from our God and came to us by way of Moses, we never practiced that. You don't find that in our Constitution. You don't find that being practiced anywhere in the United States. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, an inscription in ancient Ogham and Libyan, the language of Egyptian sailors, was found near the Rio Grande River of Texas, indicating North Africans, sponsored by an Egyptian-Libyan king named Shishong, visited North America in ancient times. The ancient inscription is translated as, "A crew of Shishong, the king, took shelter in this place of concealment," and Dr. Fell's commentary on the inscription states, quote, "Several kings of this name ruled Libya and Egypt between 1000 and 800 B.C., an era when North African voyagers began to explore the New World." Now, whether this inscription dates to the reign of King Solomon or not, it further confirms the nautical travel between the Mediterranean region and North America, and that it took place in ancient times. The phrase, "crew of Shishong, the king," may indicate that the king himself was on the voyage. Obviously, monarchs would not likely have come to the New World unless it was considered safe to leave their home kingdoms. A period of peaceful stability, as during King Solomon's reign, would have been an ideal time for just such a journey. And also, the Bible records that many monarchs did undertake international visits during the reign of Solomon, as we read in 2 Chronicles 9, verse 23 and 24. And the Bible mentions an Egyptian ruler named Shishak, for example, Shishong, sacked Jerusalem during the time of King Rehoboam of Judah, recorded in 1 Kings 14, verses 25 and 26. And while Shishak's Egypt attacked Judah, the smaller Jewish kingdom, it did not attack the much larger northern Israelite kingdom of Israel. Indeed, Egypt's Shishak was a friend of King Jeroboam of Israel, as we read in 1 Kings 11:40. So the 10 tribes of Israel in the northern kingdom of Israel likely cheered Shishak as he attacked Judah, their estranged Israelite brothers. Now, Dr. Barry Fell cited the work of Gloria Farley, who made notable finds of ancient inscriptions left by Libyans, Celts, and Phoenicians, who ascended the Mississippi, Arkansas, and Cimarron rivers. The evidence is compelling that the ancient alliance of Israel, Egypt, Tyre, and Sidon extensively explored North America during biblical times, following the river courses in Phoenician ships. And it is significant that Dr. Fell noted the time period of 1000 to 800 B.C. as marking a period of significant Old World exploration of the New World. This time frame exactly parallels biblical records showing international travel and commerce, and that it flourished with fleets undertaking multi-year voyages and visiting other continents. This time frame begins with the reigns of Kings David and Solomon, but sometimes continues through much of the history of the northern kingdom of Israel, the dominant partner in the Phoenician alliance until Israel fell in 721 BC. So the conclusion is inescapable that the record of ancient history verifies the biblical accounts, and the Bible is not a detailed history of all that happened in the ancient world. But it does confirm what archaeology and epigraphy have shown about the real state of commerce and travel in the ancient world and in North America. Now, many historical accounts confirm that the beginning of the first millennium BC marked a golden age for Phoenicia. Historian Philip Hitti states, quote, "Phoenician trade on an international scale in textiles, metals, pottery, glass, timber, wheat, and wine gave the country 3 centuries, beginning around 1000 BC, of prosperity unmatched in its history. Secular evidence that Phoenicia's greatness began around 1000 BC is critically important since it coincides precisely with the period during which King Hiram of Tyre allied his people to King David's Israelites. And since the Israelites were of a common race, language, and culture with the Phoenicians, the true Israelite role in Phoenicia's golden age has not been recognized. In fact, it was Israel's golden age rubbing off on the Phoenician city-states. Israel was the dominant partner in the Phoenician alliance, with Tyre and Sidon serving as junior partners. This conclusion is supported by the facts that Phoenicia's golden age did not start until it allied itself to Israel, and that their golden age ended when Israel fell. The small city-states of Phoenicia were unable to sustain any golden age of international power apart from their alliance with Israel." That is the northern 10 tribes of Israel, not Judah. All right, I got to pause right here and give you a reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, religion, politics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications so endorsed or recommended will reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, or call the Law School Direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call the Law School Direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book, The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel, drawing the parallels between ancient Israel's rise to greatness in the first British and American Empire, which occurred in 1000 BC. Now, we have replicated or duplicated that great kingdom or empire that our forefathers created back in the first millennium BC. We've done it today. America and Britain are the dominant powers on the world scene today, but we are in decline. We are in decline in the same way that our ancient civilizations went into decline, and finally, national captivity, destruction, the end of our rulership over the earth, or our end of our greatness. And then it was caused then by our disobedience to God. We absolutely gave him the finger. God calls it putting the branch to his nose. "Will you put the branch to my nose, saith the Eternal? Will you give me the finger?" And the answer is, yes, God, we will give you the finger. And we've been doing that in this country for 50 years plus now. And it's beginning to tell. We're the world's number one debtor nation now. And our fortunes in war aren't going nearly as well as when our God is fighting for us on our side. Our wars go a lot better when we have God working for us. But that's the way the cookie crumbles. And we made a choice. Americans, Canadians, Australians, Britons, we made a choice. We had a choice to make. Deuteronomy chapter 30, our God told us, "Choose you now this day who you're going to serve, God or Baal." And by God, we chose. We chose Baal, and now it's starting to show. Now, at this juncture, going back to the ancient narrative here, at this juncture, new observations must be made about the term Phoenicia. Now, this book has so far referred to the inhabitants of the city-states of Tyre and Sidon as Phoenicians, and to the inhabitants of Israel as Israelites. However, the term Phoenicia, when applied to the ancient world, in the time frame of 1000 to, say, 700 BC, It designates the combined alliance of the Israelites and the city-states led by Tyre and Sidon. And it must be realized that the people that we call Phoenicia did not give themselves that name. The term Phoenicia is derived from a Greek word which the Greek historians used to describe several nations living on the eastern shores of the Mediterranean Sea. And George Rawlinson wrote, at first the term Phoenicia was used by the Greeks with a good deal of vagueness. So the Phoenicians and the Israelites didn't call themselves Phoenicians. The Greeks came along and said, oh, these people are Phoenicians, and they hung that label on them. I don't know what they were calling themselves, but more likely they're calling themselves Hebrews or Israelites. I'm oftentimes called a constitutionalist. Or somebody will say to me, well, how come you're not a Christian? Well, why would I be a Christian? I'm a Hebrew. I'm a Hebrew Israelite. I practice the Mosaic Law. I practice the law of our God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's a weird combination, boys and girls. That's a strange one. And back in these days, these people weren't running around calling themselves Christians. They weren't running around calling themselves Phoenicians either, or constitutionalists. It's a name, it's a label that the foreigners, the outsiders, the aliens hung on them. They said, well, we don't know what to call these guys. Oh, we're going to call them Phoenicians. Now, at first, the term Phoenicia was used by the Greeks with a good deal of vagueness of the Syrian coast generally between Asia Minor and Egypt. The Encyclopedia Judaica states that the Greek name Phoenici is first mentioned by Homer, and it adds, though the exact extent of the region called Phoenicia cannot be determined, the name is clearly the Greek equivalent of Canaan, the land of Canaan. So the Greeks called this piece of real estate Phoenicia, their equivalent to Canaan. Lionel Casson, author of The Ancient Mariner, states concerning the Phoenicians, he said, even their name is a puzzle. They called themselves Sidonians from the city that was their chief center until Tyre outstripped it about the beginning of the first millennium B.C., and their land was Canaan. It was the Greeks who named them the Phoenicians or Phoenicians. The above accounts all indicate the term Phoenicia included a region much larger than just the small city-states on the eastern Mediterranean coast. What harmony with the Bible? You see, 1 Kings 5 verse 6 also uses the term Sidonians. But the same chapter of the Bible shows King Hiram of Tyre becoming the leader of the Phoenician city-states at the beginning of the first millennium B.C. Casson's account also affirms concerning the Phoenicians that the land of Canaan was their land. It's well known that the land of Canaan was the territory of the Israelites. They threw the Canaanites out after they came out of Egypt. The Bible actually provides us with the contemporary information about who was in the Phoenician alliance and why it became so powerful as the first millennium dawned. The Greek age of Homer is identified in Halley's Bible Handbook as being contemporary with Israel's golden age under Kings David and Solomon. The Encyclopedia Britannica lists many optional dates for Homer's birth, including 1159 B.C., 1102 B.C., 1044 B.C., and 830 B.C. The Encyclopedia Americana states that ancient tradition placed Homer in the 9th century B.C. These poetic sources suggest a date now widely accepted in the last half of the 8th century B.C. Now, while no one knows the dates of Homer's lifetime, all of the above suggested dates coincide with the period of the Israelites and when they lived in Canaan. This is important because if Homer and his fellow Greeks originated the term Phoenicia, they did so at a time when the city-states of Tyre and Sidon were so closely linked to the kingdom of Israel that they were virtually one entity. The word Phoenicia is therefore derived from an initial Greek description of the area known to us as the land of Canaan and the broader Levantine region of the eastern Mediterranean. So the term Phoenicia was applied to this area at a time when Israel was the dominant power in the region. Therefore, the original application of the term Phoenicia included Israel. The Encyclopedia Americana succinctly confirms the above conclusions in these words. Quote, the name Phoenicians was given by the Greeks to the inhabitants of the coastal region of present-day Lebanon and the adjacent shores of Israel and Syria in the first millennium B.C. No evidence exists that they called themselves by any such name. Now, this explains why the term Phoenicia is absent from the Bible. Unlike modern history texts that reflect Greco-Roman perspectives, the Bible was written from the Hebrew perspective, and it records the names by which the Phoenicians referred to themselves. Such names include Israel, Sidonians, people of Tyre, and even the names of Israel's larger tribal units. Now, after the fall of Israel in 721 B.C., the term Phoenicia remained on the smaller city-states of Tyre and Sidon, even though they lacked the manpower to sustain the empire that had existed when they were allies to the Israelites. However, during the period of 1000 to 700 B.C., the term Phoenicia meant the alliance of Israel and the city-states of Tyre and Sidon. It is not technically correct to say that the Israelites were allied to the Phoenicians, because Israel itself was the dominant member of the allied people on the eastern shores of the Mediterranean Sea who were called Phoenicians. They were called Phoenicians by the Greeks, So this explains why international power and influence characterized the Phoenicians from approximately 1000 to 700 BC, the time when Israel was in the alliance, and why the term Phoenician describes a people with severely reduced numbers and influence after 700 BC, when the Israelites were absent and the city-states were left all alone. So if you've been studying ancient history and you saw the terms Phoenician and you saw Phoenician coins found here and there, I always thought that Phoenicia, Tyre and Sidon, were independent, and that Solomon went over there and did some business with them from time to time, but there wasn't any alliance. I didn't know about that until I got into these books by Stephen Collins. So let me give Collins a plug right here. I've got four books here on my desk, and he's got a fifth one out, and he's working on the sixth. Now, if you'd like some copies of these books, the titles of the books that you're looking for, and you won't find this kind of information anywhere, and I've just scratched the surface. I'm telling you, boys and girls, I haven't covered a tenth of the story. I'm just hitting some of the major highlights that Collins has uncovered here. But Collins isn't by himself. You'll notice that I have cited here from time to time the Encyclopedia Americana, Rawlinson, Gordon. There's just a whole host and plethora of sources, secular sources, guys that don't have anything to do with the Bible or religion or church or anything else. Just the secular writers like Barry Fell. I never knew that Barry Fell had any use for the Bible. He was a Harvard professor. Gloria Farley never struck me as being religious. She's an archaeologist. And yet, what these people are writing and what Stephen Collins has put together is a story that you've never heard before and you're never going to hear again. Outside of these books, this story is buried so deep that it'll never come out. Well, not until Jesus returns and starts publishing a separate publishing company. Now, why don't you jot this number down? This is Collins' number, and I'm taking some liberty here. And ordinarily authors, they don't want anybody to call them. They just want their publisher to sell books, and they make a lot of money. This guy's going to starve to death on these books. Now, if this guy had written some books here about Christopher Columbus discovering America, well, he'd probably make $1 million. But writing a book about ancient Israel, writing books about Ogham and Celtic writing and Hebrew mounds and the Ten Commandments and things like that found here in the United States, well, he'll starve to death writing these books. Now, there's a few of us that are interested in truth in archaeology, truth in history, truth in politics. There may be as many as 7,000 of them that haven't bowed their knees to Baal yet, but there's not many. So if you're one of them, the telephone number is 605-361-5069. Now, he'll autograph these books for you if you ask him to. He did for me. I said, hey, would you autograph that for me? So you tell him little Georgie sent you and that you heard this on the radio, or you heard it on the internet or whatever, and you're looking for The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel. That's one book. And another one here, Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower and Its Role in Biblical History. The wise men who came to visit the Christ child came from Parthia. They were Israelites. And the Messiah sent his disciples out to the 10 tribes of the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Remember that? It says so right there in the New Testament. And then the third book here, Israel's Lost Empires, talks about Carthage and their empires over here in the New World. Now, this book that I'm covering today, it doesn't cover that. I mean, each one of these books covers, you know, a broader part of the whole story. Israel's Lost Empires. And then the real key book, the one that really caught my attention here, The Lost 10 Tribes of Israel Found, he's identified these 10 tribes in modern times, like Asher in South Africa. And the South African whites have now been taken into national captivity. They went first. Rhodesia and South Africa, that's where Asher settled. And the Australians, New Zealanders, Americans, and Canadians are next. You know, in World War II, God got after the Europeans. He got after the Jews, and he punished them. We got off of that punishment, but ours comes next. And this thing of putting the branch to God's nose is going to come back to haunt us. I would suggest that we rethink this, boys and girls. Maybe it's time for us to rethink giving our God the finger. I don't think that's the wisest move we've ever made. And these four books written by Stephen Collins will tell you the story from the time of David and Solomon up to today. And this book, The Lost 10 Tribes of Israel Found, identifies scientifically, archaeologically, and historically, based upon the Bible's prophecies as to where those 10 tribes are today. An amazing collection of books. I call them 1 in 100 reads, and that's because there's nothing else like them. So let me give you that name and address again. Remember the publisher, in case I don't do it again, BibleBlessings.net. That's the website, BibleBlessings.net. The publishing house is Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068-1778. Remember, the post office box is 1778, so the zip plus 4 is 48068-1778. That's Bible Blessings. Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Now, the reason I gave you his phone number at 605-361-5069 is because he'll autograph them and you can get them all. You see, he's published these books through different publishers, and that publishing house, Bible Blessings, isn't the same publisher that put out this other book here called The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found. And for that reason, you know, the Bible Blessings people may not have that book. They may or may not. But Collins does. And the five books for $100 is what I got them for, and I think he'll sell them to you for the same price and autograph them for you too. And it'll do his heart good. You know, put in a good word to him, because this guy has spent a tremendous amount of effort and work on these books. I've written a little myself, and I can tell you that it takes a lot of time, effort, and energy to research out these facts and figures, put it down on paper, and then send it in, get it written up, proofread, published, and then get it out there. And nobody's going to buy these books. I mean, let's be honest to God, realists over here. People don't buy revisionist history. This guy is a historical revisionist. I mean, he's liable to end up in a concentration camp writing this kind of stuff. I don't think they'll call him a terrorist. I think they'll call him some kind of a hate monger. Some kind of a historical revisionist. Well, they got a name for that, some kind of a dirty name for people that want to get to the roots of history and tell the truth about it. All right, so that's the story on Stephen Collins. Now, King Solomon's golden age and Israel's empire goes on. After Israel fell, the term Phoenicia remained on the smaller city-states of Tyre and Sidon, even though they lacked the manpower to sustain the empire that had existed when they were allied to the Israelites. Now, this series of books will sometimes refer to Phoenicians and Israelites, but the reader should realize that during the lifetime of the Kingdom of Israel, the term Phoenicia included the Israelites. So Phoenicia is synonymous with Israel. That's why nobody's able to put their finger on the dead body. They think that Phoenicia is, you know, the city-states of Tyre and Sidon. They haven't put together the biblical connection. Now, the alphabet and other Phoenician inventions. Other remarkable developments occurred in the eastern Mediterranean around 1000 BC. The Encyclopedia Americana notes the following. About 1000 BC, Phoenicia suddenly developed new types of pottery, biochrome, trichrome, and red polished ware that had no prototypes in the late Bronze Age. Clearly, about the beginning of the first millennium, the culture of the area underwent a change and an acceleration. And that's because of King Solomon. Solomon, remember, got this wisdom from God. You know what this boils down to is that this story of evolution, where man is getting smarter and smarter and all the time, is just horse pucky. The truth of the matter is we were pretty damn smart in ancient times and got real dumb during the Dark Ages and are just now getting back to where we were. You know, had we obeyed God and kept his commandments, we probably would have been 10 times further ahead of where we are today, technologically and in our civilization. I suspect that that's why God destroyed the pre-flood world. They were probably making space flights. And he said, you know, these guys are smarter then their brains and their character will stand. I better cut this thing short. Now, interestingly, at the approximate time of King Solomon's reign, the technical skills of the Phoenicians took a great leap forward. What caused this sudden advance in technical skills? Well, the Bible tells us that God gave King Solomon a gift of unprecedented wisdom and understanding. 1 Kings 3:12 and 1 Kings 10:24 adds that all the earth consulted Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. Apparently, Solomon's wisdom was not limited to ethical and sociological matters. Remember the Israelite invention of the Bessemer process in the large blast furnace complex that we discussed in the previous chapter, which was developed during the time of Israel's golden age? Well, God made Solomon a genius in many fields, and his inventions and insights not only caused him to be held in awe by others, but they revolutionized the culture and the commerce of the day. That the above technologies suddenly developed within Israel, Phoenicia, around 1000 BC, indicates the presence of a genius who accelerated their culture. The Bible tells us that that genius was King Solomon. You know, if we would obey God and keep his commandments, you know, we have in our history people like Henry Ford and Thomas Edison. We have a lot of inventions and a lot of inventive genius that has come about over the last 100 years here in America. Not just here, but in the Israelite countries. And now we find that we have just about reached the apex. You know, we've gotten to a point, you know, where we're getting ourselves into trouble. This nuclear technology is a genie that's out of the jar. Now the Iranians want it. It's going to come back and bite us in the butt, boys. Well, King Solomon's golden age, the Israel Empire, the Israelites, rise to greatness in ancient Israel, was in fact the people that later became the British and American empires of the modern 19th, 20th, and 21st century. We are the descendants of those people. Now, Collins goes a little bit further than that. In his book, The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found, he identifies with specificity each one of the 10 tribes and then gives you the biblical historicity of each one of them. I haven't got the time to do that now. We're about out of time. But, you know, here's the tribe of Reuben, the eldest son of Jacob. And he's got, you know, several pages of the story of Reuben. All you French people over there, where did you people come from? Do you know where your roots really lie? Remember that Alex Haley, you know, wrote the book Roots, the black guy looking for his ancestry? Well, how about the roots of you French? How about Zebulun over here? Where does Zebulun come into the picture? Where do the Dutch people today live? What are their roots? How do you trace back these Dutch people today, back through history, back into the Bible, and identify yourselves? Did you know that you came from the tribe of Zebulun? And Asher, the people of Rhodesia in South Africa, the people with all the gold, he's identified them. Issachar, the tribe of Issachar, and Benjamin up in Norway. Naphtali over in Finland, and the tribe of Dan in Denmark, and Gad over in Germany and Switzerland, and the tribe of Judah over in what's called Israel today. You know, every one of these tribes is identified. Simeon and Levi were absorbed into the other tribes. And you'll see that in this book called The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found. And they're not small books either. You know, since 395, hell, this is 400 and plus pages, 425 pages. So this guy has spent a lot of time, effort, and energy. I want to give you his name and number one more time. It's Stephen Collins. His phone number is 605-361-5069. That's area code 605-361-5069. And if you don't want to buy all of his books, just buy one. Just buy one. But let me recommend this. The first book you want is The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found. I mean, that is dynamite beyond dynamite. I mean, that's real plastic explosives. And then the story on Parthia. He's got a story in The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found about Jesus Christ coming to the New World. That'll just tickle all of you Mormons out there. I mean, if that doesn't tickle you Mormons out there, nothing will. And this Parthia over here talking about the wise men, where'd they come from? And Parthia was the counterbalance to the Roman Empire. That's the Israelites. The Israelites under a different name. And Israel's lost empires talks about their colonies and Hannibal. Almost defeating the Roman Empire, Carthage, and their outposts and colonies here in the New World in greater detail than anything that I've covered so far. And remember, I've just barely scratched the surface. And I haven't told you jack squat yet, but boy, I told you a bunch that you never heard before. All right, we're about out of time, boys and girls. That's the story of Stephen Collins and the Israel's Lost Empires, Israel's Rise to Greatness, the First British and American Empire. Next week, we'll come back and we'll talk about something else. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Remember, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And if you like this program or you want to look at this series of programs and you only heard one, you can go to the Internet and pick it up. All right, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So thanks for listening, and good night, friends.